Hey guys, this is JP with REITips.com, and this is a follow-up interview to my interview with Bob Norton from a few days ago, just right before the holiday. Bob is here with me on the line. How's it going, buddy?
Going great.
We're going to rattle through the remaining questions that were in queue at the end of our Secret Profits session. Before I jump into that, though, I do have just a couple of housekeeping issues I need to get out of the way really quick. First off, if you're listening to this right now and you have not heard the first session, then I would highly recommend, first of all, that you go listen to that. This is not going to make a whole lot of sense to you if you don't. What we're going to do now is building upon that. So please go listen to that first session. There's a link to it on this page. Secondly, I want to say I really appreciate all of the really nice feedback and the emails and such from everyone after we recorded part A of our conversation. Including those who were on the line with us and those who have listened to it afterwards, apparently really struck a chord of interest with more than a few people. If you caught my audio postcard just recently, then you already know, due to the interest that seems to have been stirred up, we're actually looking at the possibility of opening up some private in-house training sessions that we're actually already putting together for some of Bob's local coaching students, and maybe also open that up for some of the folks from REI Tips who might want to go through it as well, but we need to get your feedback on that. Bob, basically, we want to document your system, and this is the best way to do it.
Yes.
And let other people be a part of it. We want to put together something that takes from start to finish what you do and uncovers the whole thing so that you can then hand it off to your local coaching students there. And this is not a ploy for his coaching, by the way. Bob doesn't have any coaching spots available or anything, but we want to do it in a way that his local students can consume it and digest it and then just apply it themselves. It's a really intimate, personal walkthrough of his entire model, start to finish. We're just going to do our best not to leave any stone unturned, no question unanswered. It would be a tuition-based thing. We don't really know how much right now, but we want to keep it very affordable and within reach of most anyone who would want to go through it if we end up going that route. It'd probably take, 4 to 5 sessions. It's a pretty straightforward model. It should not be real complicated to go through. And we'd probably try to condense that down to within a couple of weeks or so. In my in the audio postcard, if you caught that the other day, I actually asked you guys to please tell us if you have a possible interest in something like this. We need to know. If there's not enough interest, then there's no point in doing it. So I had a survey, and there's also a link to that survey right here as well. If you haven't answered those two questions for me, would you please go ahead and do that? The first question is, are you even possibly interested in something like this? And secondly, if so, what would you like to make sure it includes? So go ahead and answer that for me if you don't mind. There's a link right here on this page, so you can do that if you haven't done it already. Bob, before we jump into all the questions, I didn't have you on the line when I did that audio postcard the other day. Do you think you could just kind of give a quick Reader's Digest version, maybe some quick bullet points of some of the stuff that you know you're already planning to cover for the people who are a part of that gig that we're putting on?
Sure, that's no problem. I want people to completely understand my model and really how simple it is. But we'll be covering how to gain access to the MLS and how to utilize the MLS in such a way that you can run extremely powerful searches that will act as a screening agent for you, and basically how you can identify great leads without having to look at a lot of properties. We're also going to be going through how to learn the real values of the comparable sales on the MLS and how to utilize the MLS in such a way to find all of the buyers who are buying properties, investors, and homeowners in your area. To follow up on that even more, we're going to be identifying the hotbeds through the MLS, the flipping hotbeds. And what I mean by that is the areas where flipping not only makes sense, but where flips are happening and very profitable flips without a lot of people knowing about it. I'll teach you how to do that through the MLS. We'll be discussing how to find the best mortgage brokers, the top-selling realtors, and how to utilize them and to make them your team members. And then we'll go in depth of how to piggyback off of other professionals who are doing excellent right now in this market, and then how to utilize them in such a way to where they can potentially manage your rehabs, do all the marketing for you, and really act as another team member for you so that you can really focus on just finding great deals. And that's my key focus, is if you can get really good at finding great deals, then everything else will kind of fall into place. So we'll go through how to talk about the art of selling a wholesale house versus a wholesale or retail house, how to line up private lenders, and really how to do, my average profit per deal is between $25,000 and $30,000, and how to do that without spending any money on direct marketing, and how to do that without managing any contractors or doing a rehab. I guess, JP, I could keep going. There's a lot of other things we can do, but to really get a good idea of my model, it's utilizing the MLS, focusing on how to find great deals, and then how to use others to kind of get everything else done for you.
Well, there's a few things that you do really well. You're really good at, like you said, using the MLS in a really powerful way to extract the right kind of information and then leverage it in this model in a way that most people don't even think about leveraging it. So I just want to let people know, I know some people are already thinking, well, the MLS is a little different in every area, and it is. That when we go through that part of it, it is going to be a visual. You'll see Bob going through his MLS, but the chances are probably almost every MLS is going to have very similar functionality. They're all pretty much competitive to each other now, and it may look a little different or smell a little different, but it's going to be a very similar type of thing. You just have to go in and tweak it slightly to make it work for you. I can also hear some people saying, I don't have access to the MLS, and I know one of the things that you're going to make sure and cover as well is ways that you can get access to the MLS in order to be able to accomplish this.
Yeah, and that's the most important thing, is access to the MLS. You have to be ethical. For a lot of people, it's easier just to be a realtor. But, just to demonstrate this, I put a comment out there on a message board the other day. I have access to the MLS in 5 different states right now. And all I did was ask for it, and I got it. So it wasn't difficult. It was easy. It's just finding the right person who might be willing to work with you to get you access to the MLS. There's all sorts of different strategies of how to do that. But this is such a gold mine it's such a powerful database that people just don't utilize. And that's where 80% of all real estate transactions are running through the MLS. So, that I try to go where the majority of the transactions are going. And I think we've already said that, but I'm a marketing cheapskate. So, I'd rather try to find deals and find the people who are making deals happen without having to spend a lot of money on marketing.
Well, and that blows a lot of people's minds, and mine. I mean, really, frankly, the fact that you're able to be as successful as you are in this without really spending anything marketing to acquire houses and really not spending anything marketing to sell them because of the strategic alliances that you form selectively with the right people to get those things sold, I mean, fast in a market where houses just don't sell fast, and to do it without, throwing marketing dollars. And the fact that you do it without having to go in and do a whole lot of rehab on the houses, and that you're selling them to retail buyers, it's a really unique model. So I'm not going to go over the whole model again. That's what part A of our conversation is for. But we're going to cover the whole gambit of it. We're going to take some elements of it and go really, really deep into them. But by the end of it, you should not only have your mind wrapped around this model and really fully understand it, but you should know how to then turn around and apply it yourself. So thank you for running through that. Why don't we jump into some of the questions now and go ahead and get going?
Sounds good.
All right. The first thing I want to do is deal with the email we got from Pat. And, in our last call, we covered, to some detail, we covered how a window of opportunity within the FHA program that's opened up in today's market has been serving your business model. I don't want to reconstitute all that and go over it again right now, but Pat sent us an email concerned about some of the details that we discussed and basically feeling like some of it wasn't accurate. He's a broker, an FHA, kind of an FHA specialist, and he called into question some things. And let me say this, Pat, I appreciate you doing that. We are certainly, we're kind of an open book here, and if you feel like there's something that was said that wasn't accurate, that needs to be restated or reapproached, then we're very open to that. I know Bob responded to you personally. Bob, if you don't mind, just kind of quickly recap a little bit of what his concerns were around and what your response was. And I know he's responded to you since then and you guys you know, very positively, but can you just kind of recap that so we can lay that out there for anyone else who may have had the same thoughts?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. The first thing that he did is he basically said, I listened to it and I thought that there was some information that was incorrect, and that he's a full-time mortgage broker. And what he wanted to point out is FHA has not gotten easier in most cases. The first thing he pointed out is that FHA loans used to be 100% financeable, because you could do something like the Nehemiah program where you could get 3% gift funds from a family member, or use like a Meridream, and you could actually figure out how to put a deal together where the borrower didn't have to put up any money at all. And the first thing that I want to acknowledge is you are completely correct. FHA, in that sense, has gotten more difficult. He also pointed out that FHA used to never be credit score driven. It used to be that you could not have a credit score at all and still get an FHA loan, and now lenders are requiring that you have some type of minimum credit score. So, you know, having said that, I think what I want to clarify is, first of all, he is completely correct. In that sense, FHA has gotten more difficult. However, my response back to him was, what I wanted to point out is FHA is by far and away the easiest loan program available now compared to all the other mortgage programs out there. And on top of that, appraisers are also getting a little bit more lackadaisical and taking on, and I don't even know if that's the right word, but they're a little bit more lenient because they're trying to take on more of a role as an appraiser looking at the overall value of a property instead of as an inspector. And what we're finding and what's happening is if a property is normally appraising for $150,000 and you're selling it to someone who's getting FHA financing for $100,000, sometimes the appraisers don't come down too heavy on all the things that need done to renovate that home simply because that's not their job. They're just strictly playing by what they're asked to do and nothing more. So getting that out there, Pat promptly replied back and he said, and I'm quoting him, I do agree that FHA is the easiest way to go. They have tightened up some things as far as down payments, and then he just goes on to say that the appraisers don't look too closely at plumbing, et cetera, because they're not inspectors. So what we want to convey is that FHA, in terms of what it used to be, may not be easier, but in terms of what is out there and available now, it is by far the easiest thing available to borrowers.
Right, and I think also two things about FHA. One is it is one element of your business model. We may have put more emphasis on it than we needed to because there is this open window that, you know, frankly, most people are missing because in a reaction to their fear of today's lending environment. And it's there, and you have capitalized on it, and you continue to. But it's really not the crux of what you're doing and why you're so successful in what you're doing right now in this market. Really, your larger model focuses around this wholetailing model where you take, you acquire a house using a certain formula, and then you flip it quickly with little or no rehab to a retail. You wholesale it to a retail buyer or wholetale, borrowing Sean McCloskey's terminology there. So I think that's one thing about the FHA that we want to really be loud and clear on. And then, as you said, we're not experts in that arena. I know one of the things we're going to be doing is interviewing somebody who is and providing a little bit more insight in that. But you said to me before, one thing we want to emphasize is not only are you not an expert in FHA, but you're intentionally not, and you don't have to be in order to capitalize on this the way that you are. We're not saying you got to go out here and learn the FHA loan program inside out.
And, you know, I guess I look at that as the market's changing all the time. I don't want to clutter my brain up with all the new latest and greatest underwriting criteria. You know, that's, I find the right team member. I find the right mortgage broker who's going to be on my team. And if he says, yes, this is going to go, then it's going to go. And I don't worry about that, and I don't want to know the details. I just know that overall, if you look at in proportion to what's been selling, a much higher percentage of properties are now selling with FHA financing that used to not do that. And that's probably the biggest reason is because subprimes dried up, stated incomes dried up, zero down loans have dried up. So more of the pressure is going on in the programs where there's less capital to be put down, and that would be FHA. But I try my hardest to not go FHA because I want to sell my property in 30 days. I don't want to wait 90 days. I want to sell it with, usually I get anxious if it's been more than a week. I think I'm doing something wrong. So I am severely, I'm impatient, and I want my money back very quickly. And I'm not the type of person who can just let it sit out there and wait a couple months. So FHA is a great option, and I've done that many times. But again, the point is my model is more of I'm selling properties conventional with buyers putting 20% down because they're getting such a great deal.
And seemingly contrary to what other people feel is possible in this market, you're doing very well with it. Having said that, let's jump into the next series set of questions that we got here.
Sure.
We got one from Soraya, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name there, but I think it's Soraya. JP, if you don't mind, I have a question. Bob's clean REOs go for around $280,000, in which he applies the 70% minus repairs formula. The clean REOs that I'm working go for around $150,000. Would Bob say that I can still use the 70% minus repairs at this price point?
Most definitely. I like that price point. The one thing I would caution is what I'm finding is buyers want more than they wanted, you know, even 6 months ago or a year ago. A good example is, you know, we just bought an SUV recently, and we're out there looking, and, you know, I said to my wife, here's your budget. Well, she's got a budget, and she wants more than just an SUV. She wants nice rims, she wants heat warmers, seat warmers, you know, she wants all the little gadgets and buttons and DVD players and all these type of things, and that's what she's looking for, and she was patiently looking until she found what she wanted. Home buyers are the exact same way. They want a garage. They want the basements. You know, they want the nice yard, the great school district, the master bathroom, the tile. And if you can offer those type of things, and those are bones. What I mean by bones are, you know, like let's look at the flooring. You could put in really nice flooring, or you could put in cheap linoleum or carpet. You know, but the flooring is the flooring. Bones are things that are structural, that are with the house, that are always going to stay there. So I don't necessarily get hung up on what type of flooring or what color paint I'm putting into a house, but what I'm looking for is those nice open basements, those two-car garages, things that are very difficult to really add on unless you're going to structurally change the layout of a house. So what you want to keep in mind is when you're looking at that 150 number, is that a clean REO number for three-bedroom, one-bath homes, or is that a clean REO number for four-bedroom, two-bath on a basement kind of homes? And the one other thing is I like to go at 60. I try to target 60%, not 70. And sometimes I will accept 70, depending on the situation. But when I make offers, I'm shooting for 60. I want to make that out there. And the other thing is there's always, you know, there's certain parts of town where the clean REO market is at 50 grand. But I don't want to buy properties for 20 and try to sell them for 50. I want to go to the clean REO market that's got the what buyers are looking for, the four beds, two baths type of area. And I don't, JP, do I need to clarify that a little bit more? Does that make sense?
No, I think that makes sense to me. And if there's anyone listening who doesn't understand what you mean by clean REOs, maybe you could just give us a quick definition of what you mean by that.
The clean REOs are the houses that just need cosmetic work only, and they're foreclosures, and typically there's an average price point that if you have enough foreclosures in your area, they almost create their own market. Clean foreclosures, clean REOs are homes that sell on the MLS at a discount, but not too heavily of a discount, because they're basically in move-in condition. They may not be completely decked out from top to bottom, but they're the type of properties where you can pretty much move in without really having to spend much money.
And those are the kinds that do wholesale.
Yeah, you might have pink walls or green carpet or something, but those, again, those are cosmetics. And,
right,
those
right.
are homes that sold at retail at the top of the market, and just because the homeowner was moving out of the property, there's just going to be a little bit of wear and tear on the property.
Okay, so just to drill a little deeper on that, to really crystallize it, obviously if the house has, holes in the roof, or if it has, if it's missing a floor in a room or fire damage, that certainly doesn't qualify as a clean REO. Those are much beyond cosmetic. But what about a house that has, let's say you walk in and it's stinky because the people had like 9 cats and they peed all over the carpets, so it smells bad. The walls have never been washed or painted since the people lived in the house, but it's structurally sound. And let's say everything in the kitchen and bathrooms is, dated 30 years. Would that be a clean REO, or would that be marginal? How would you classify it? Because there's a lot of those out there, I can tell you.
You bring up something that's really good. What I'm trying to do is there's a real market for houses that don't repel homeowners. Homeowners are willing to accept a certain level of abuse and wear and tear on a house, and in their minds they recognize that there's nothing wrong with that house, but they want a discount. It's like the guy who's willing to buy a used car versus a new car. Well, a guy who wants to buy a used car, he might still want to get one of those GM certified cars where he knows that everything is good mechanically, but they don't want a car that's got stinky diapers in the back and things like that. This is the same thing as houses that smell where they had pets. Usually those are great opportunities for me to buy, but it's going to repel the potential homeowner. So if a house has those type of things, I will typically always re-carpet the house. And usually I call it white boxing, but I'll go in and I'll just spray everything one color. For as far as painting goes, and so I make it very neutral, and I that way they go in there and they kind of feel like, boy, this is. And the reason I'm doing that is I want to keep my costs down. I don't want to try to spend a lot of money to sell it to a retail buyer. I want to do it, and I just want to bring the property up to such a level to where the buyer's getting a discount. They feel like they're getting a discount. They feel like there's a few things wrong with the house, but yet nothing that's going to repel them. And I'll tell you, women do not, they can't get past the urine. They can't. They it's in the wood. It's never going to leave. We can't get rid of it. And so I definitely, if those houses come along, I get excited. Because now I'm, as far as me buying the property, a lot of my competition, which is the homeowner, has been eliminated. Now it kind of drops into that investor market.
Okay, so let me feed it back to you, because I think I got it, and I think I got an interesting word picture that really honed it in. I had a friend of mine who, I'm licensed also, so I don't do a lot of retail stuff as a realtor, but if I have friends or something that need help and they want me to help them find a house, then I'm willing to do it. I just refuse to actually wash my car or dress up when I go out with them. So having said that, this guy came to me, he was a guy I knew from church, and said, hey, I want to buy a fixer-upper. He just had this, kind of a romantic picture in his mind of going out and buying a fixer-upper and, putting some sweat equity into it, getting a great deal, and then having something with some equity left on the other side. And we got out there, and I said, well, great, I'm an investor, and I know what a fixer-upper is, so I can guide you to some stuff and help you analyze the numbers. So as we were going through stuff, I quickly realized he's really not looking for what I would call a fixer-upper. He's looking for something that a complete non-investor, you know, basically somebody who the limit of their experience and knowledge is from Flip This House. He's looking for something that is going to appeal to him, that he can basically just go in and paint, and things that look like, you know, that he can go and fix up and be really proud of, but that aren't really going to jar him when he walks in. But I guess I think what I'm hearing you say is it needs to be okay for that kind of person. So when you have something that's still truly a cosmetic issue, like, you know, urine-soaked carpet, that's a pretty easy fix for guys like me and you. It's something that wouldn't steer you away because of it, but it's something you'd want to take care of in order to classify it in that clean REO box to make it marketable to the type of buyer that you're working with in this market, right?
Yeah, you've hit it dead on. What happened is I've been selling homes retail, I've been selling homes wholesale, and I started to get a lot of feedback from the realtors, and this is what buyers want. They wake up, they feel like they are an absolute fool if they don't buy a house with some equity in this market. Every
right.
buyer knows it's a buyer's market. They want to be able to know, confidently tell their friends or family members that they got a house with equity. They got a deal. That's what they want. They don't really want the fixer-upper house. They really want the equity. They don't want to spend a bunch of their time doing a bunch of repairs. They want to do it a little bit just to say they did it. But deep down, if you really analyze what they're looking for, your friend being an example, they want equity. They don't want to go through all the headache of, so what does that do? They go out and they start looking at 5, 10, 15 foreclosures, and they get completely burned out. You know, they're going, oh, my gosh, man, contractors, and it just becomes overwhelming to them. Then they come along and they see a house and they go, wow, we can steam clean the carpets, we can paint this place, and, you know, if we want, we could put in granite instead of the formica that works there. If we got a budget, if not, then everything's great. And you know what? I'm going to go out to the back of the deck and do a little bit of staining. That's their idea of putting a lot of, you know, sweat equity into a deal. That's all they want to do.
Right.
So what I do is I like to target properties, particularly moldy houses. I love mold. Mold, I have done so well with mold houses. Every great deal I've ever done has been a mold house. And I like the houses that got a lot of mold. And what I do is I go in there and I just remediate the mold and sometimes all the problems that come with the mold. And then I get a mold remediation certificate and then I sell the house. And I try to take away anything that's going to scare them off.
Do you hire someone
sometimes
to do
that?
That
might mean doing a $10,000 or $20,000 rehab, but I'm not going to repaint the house and I'm not going to put in new carpet and those type of things. I'm just going to do the things that won't scare them away.
Oh, so, okay, now that's an important point because I may have misunderstood you previously. With this model, typically, I thought that, you know, when it comes to doing a $10,000 or $20,000 rehab, you're typically going to pass in this market and go for something that's maybe a $5,000 or less rehab, you know, prehab as you called it in the last call, because it's quick and easy and so low risk. And was I mistaken in that, or where's your line that you're drawing there? Because I know you're not going to go in and do like an $80,000 rehab, like a Steve Cook special. So where are you drawing your line?
Well, I'm glad that you're bringing that up. I want to really clarify that. Sometimes a $10,000 rehab, a $10,000 rehab can be a nightmare, or it can be writing one check to one subcontractor. It depends what's going on with the house. I want it to be easy, but the dollar amount doesn't determine if it's easy or not. So let me try to clarify that. If I'm doing a little house, a three-bedroom house, and I need to do kitchen, bath, carpet, paint, and I want it to look a certain way, that's getting more hands-on. You know, I got to do a punch-out list. I might have to have two or three different people going through there, and I gotta make sure the details look good. I, like anything, there's that saying, the devil is in the details. I don't need to get into the details. I just want to, it's like the 80-20 rule. I want to take care of the majority of the 80% of the problem with 20% of the effort. And so what I'm doing is I'm looking at things that I can just call, let's go back to that mold situation. I can just call one person who can remediate the mold, and they'll go out there, they'll take care of that one thing. It might take 3 days, and I might have to write them a check for $10,000. But I can make a lot more money buying a house that's moldy and scaring people off, and then and get rid of that problem, solve that problem, and then sell the house in as-is condition, but in a clean as-is condition, versus going in there and trying to remediate the mold, then do the carpet, make sure all the doorknobs are straight, make sure the doors don't rub, that all the plumbing works, you know, that I got the windows. It just, it, once you get started with that retail mode, it seems like it's never-ending, and it takes way too much of my time and attention.
That so fits your personality. You are such a broad strokes kind of guy. Like, I can absolutely see. I mean, you want to go in and say, okay, you know, let's overlay the roof. Let's clear out the backyard and cut down that tree and spray all the walls white and replace the carpet. And you write like four easy checks for four things that you can just go lay eyes on one time and make, you know, one simple decision with. But you don't want to have to say, you don't want to have to answer questions like what kind of knobs for the cabinets.
And when you do a retail house, that's what you have to do. And again, there's nothing wrong with doing that. What I've noticed is most of the buyers aren't even going there now. It used to be that that's what buyers really wanted, and now buyers want that, but they don't. They want equity. So how do you offer them equity? Well, the last thing you want to do in offering equity is to sell them a smoking, completely 100% retailed home, and then have to drop it in price by 10 or 20%. That's not how I like to offer equity. The way I've learned to offer equity is to get a great deal with equity, do enough to overcome any major fears they might have, and then pass along that great deal. And that's why it's called wholetail. I'm really wholesaling to homeowners. I've just found a different group of buyers because we're like Walmart. If I get a great deal, I'm going to pass that great deal along. That's what the buyers want. They want that equity. But at the same time, it gets a little tricky because you got to take away some of the major concerns and fears. And I like, you know, people ask me, I sold a house a couple months ago without a furnace. And someone said, well, man, that's a big deal. You got to have a furnace, especially in Michigan. And I said, don't do anything with the furnace. Let's leave it as a negotiating point. I want them to feel like they have something to come back at me at and negotiate for, because they want to negotiate. They want to brag to their friends and to their family and to everybody that, oh, I negotiated that guy down even more than the price that he was asking. They don't want to do it a lot, and they don't really know how to do it, but they just want to do it through a third party, so they don't want to do it face-to-face, so they're kind of hiding behind their realtor. But they want to feel like they came away in this market where they know that values are dropping, but yet they want a house. They want to come away and feel really good about them being on top of the transaction.
Right.
I want to stroke their ego. I want them to feel like they are they're the one that got the better of me. And I want them to feel that way. And sometimes I need to leave a few things on the table for them that they can negotiate that I know are obvious problems, but they're not difficult problems.
Right. It means understanding the things that they are going to perceive as this house being a diamond in the rough, but it won't be so much as to scare them away.
Correct. And that's that clean foreclosure market. That's why you see most of the houses selling at that part of the market, because they're getting somewhat of a discount, but not a huge discount. They're getting 10 or 20% off of retail is typically what they're able to, where a lot of the transactions, and they feel great about that, because, you know, they come away, and I'll use my in-laws as an example. They just moved next door to me. I shouldn't say next door. They moved about two blocks away from me here in Utah, and, you know, they were able to get a deal that was 30% less than retail, yet by the time they put in all their work, they might only have a house that's discounted 10% of retail, but that doesn't matter. They felt like they got a great deal, and that was enough. And it was one of those clean REO houses. The cabinets were in, but the countertops weren't in. Everything else, you know, some of the landscaping wasn't done. Well, those are things that people can get over, There's another house that's like a few doors down from them where there's no cabinets, no furnace, no, just it's all at the drywall phase. And they could have got that house for another $100,000, $150,000 cheaper, but that was too much for them. That was a property where they felt like in their minds it was going to be too much work. And so that's where the market's at. These houses that are bombs, I still like to go after them. When I rehab them, I don't get into such a nitty-gritty detail. Instead, I like to put it out there enough to where it's priced at that clean foreclosure market. So, you know, one more thing I want to bring up here is this is one of the real benefits of being a realtor, is as a realtor, you can go out there and you can look at all these homes that are selling as clean foreclosures, and you can walk through them, you could set up a showing, and you don't have to necessarily be an agent to do this. It just makes it a lot easier. You then investigate the market. You're checking out all these properties, and then you're going back and watching them and seeing what they sell for. And pretty soon you can get a really good idea of what the buyers are wanting and what stuff is selling for. And I like to play a little game where I'll walk into a house. I need to buy it for $120. It's listed for $179. And I like to predict what I think it's going to sell for. So then I predict that this is going to, I'm still going to offer $120, but I predict it's going to sell for $155. And then it sells for $165, and I'm like, oh, okay, I was off a little bit there. And if I'm off, if I'm continually lower than what it's selling for, then I readjust my formula, and I might need to come in a little higher on my offer price. Instead of offering $120, I might offer $130, because the market's paying $10,000 or $15,000 more than I thought they were going to pay.